The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informal look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage, PeteEvans.com, to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it.
Aubrey, thank you so much for joining us once again. How are you, my friend?
I'm good, brother. It's good to talk to you.
It is really good to talk to you. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to go round two as well. I'm always...
No doubt. Last one was powerful.
Yeah, I'm always interested in how this works, how these connections manifest. And, you know, I'm wearing my Superman superhero t-shirt today because... I'm always quite inspired by people that stand up and break the mold, so to speak, of pushing not only their own boundaries, but also the boundaries of what is considered, dare I say, normal in today's world. Whereas what I believe, my perception is humans would always be pushing their boundaries and exploring and the adventurers in life. And you have always come across as someone that really likes to explore what this world has to offer, both externally and internally. And so it's with great honor that you've come back to share some more of your wisdom. I watched your recent documentary about facing the darkness, and it was so beautiful, my friend. It was so beautiful. It was so raw, so vulnerable.
Thank you, bro.
So inspiring. And I thought we could take a bit of a deep dive into why the darkness, what is it that you're hoping to find in these adventures or these explorations of a modern day, of a modern day pioneer? Is it? So I'm going to hand it over to you now, and please take us on the journey for why you are a seeker or a searcher.
Well, the easy answer to that is that I have a lot to work on myself. You know, I have a lot of things that I feel very blessed with, everything, all the attributes that I carry in my life and who I am and how I was raised and so many blessings. But with that come innumerable challenges as well. And I'm the type of person, when I'm in pain or when I see a challenge, I'm going to try and find the best solution, not only to ameliorate the symptoms of that problem, but to get to the root, to get to the core of what's really bothering me. And in doing so, share that information and the techniques, tools, wisdom, anything that I've gained along the way, so that others can, you know, learn from what I've learned. So that's really it. It's really a matter of necessity, whether that's me founding on it, you know, and creating tools for human optimization. Well, a big part of that is I wanted the best tools for human optimization for myself because I wanted to be performing at my best. And when it comes to something like the darkness, I was hurting. I was hurting. And I thought that this could bring about a deeper understanding of some things that I was blinded to, you know, blinded by the light, like the song lyric said. And it really did that. You know, my 6 full days of immersion in absolute total darkness was the most powerful ceremony I've ever been a part of. And I've done 30 ayahuasca journeys, every other sacred plant medicine journey, all of the other initiations, not all of them, but as many initiations as you can imagine, I've probably been a part of them. And the darkness was absolutely the most powerful and most challenging of them all.
Explain to people what it is that you actually went through for somebody that hasn't heard of this. And
yeah,
for anybody that wants to explore another version of this, and I had the great opportunity to speak to Dr. Edith Ubuntu, and she took us through her dark room immersion probably about a year ago, actually. And, mm-hmm. and a dear friend of ours, Dan Regan, who is a practitioner of the gene keys and other modalities as well, he was telling us a couple of years ago, he came over to our place for an interview with Nick and I, and he was mentioning it, and it was the first time I'd ever heard of it. And he said he went in for 10 days, and when he came out, he wanted to go straight back in for another 10 days, I think, and I think he did because... He didn't get exactly what he needed, and he wanted to go back in. So explain dark room or dark therapy, or what is the correct terminology mm-hmm. for this modality?
Both. Yeah, both. I mean, yeah, dark therapy, you know, darkness therapy is definitely one of the more clinical ways that you can describe it. It's being used as a therapeutic approach in a lot of Eastern Europe in particular, Czech Republic in particular. But it's been around as an initiatory and transformational experience in cultures around the world, from the Kogi in Colombia to, you know, deep, you know, Hindu mystery school traditions. And it's been a part of our understanding. I mean, that idea of like go into a cave, well, what does a cave represent? Cave black is actually a way that you describe absolute darkness. You know, you can get to a point in the cave where the cave winds around to such a point that you no longer see the light that comes from the mouth of the cave, and you're just in absolute black. And that's where the term comes from, and this idea of going into the cave. And for anybody, imagine that if you are, let's say, a compulsive eater, right? Imagine you're a compulsive eater, and then you go through a 7-day fast. Right? Like you're going to rewire a lot of your relationship to eating during that period. And for me, I was compulsive to a lot of things, taking for granted a lot of the elements of my amazing life. I was also compulsively caught in different patterns and different loops and different ways in which the ordinary world was, it was difficult for me to break out. Now, of course, the medicine journeys could help me get a different perspective, but even an ayahuasca journey, you go through that experience, you fall asleep, you wake up the next morning and you're in the ordinary world just as you were before. And you're like, wow, that was a really powerful dream. And maybe it'll change your life. Certainly some of them have, but there was something I could feel about the prolonged stay in the darkness where it was just me confronting my mind for, you know, for a week. And what it is it's absolute black, not a pinprick of light, not one little, you know, photon that's escaping into the room in any way to illuminate anything. And then also silence and also isolation. So a lot of the elements that you would get from a Vipassana, which is silence and meditation, but just stacking darkness and isolation from people on top of that. So you're really just in this void, in this womb space where it's you and your mind and your spirit. And the interesting phenomenon that occurs is, for me, it was 3 days in, but there's an endogenous DMT activation that happens. So you actually end up in a visionary state. And the visionary state then lasts until you leave the dark room, right? It lasted 3 full days where I was in this extended DMT trip that was just created through the endogenous activation of this compound in my own mind. And man, it was an intense journey, and so different from ordinary reality that it just recalibrated the way that I look at all aspects of my regular life, because everything is different. Now you have people who are taking care of you. There's a blacked out hallway outside the room where they would drop off food and ring a little bell, let me know that there was some food there. And I would stumble my way into the darkness, put my hand in some avocado and some salad and be like, damn it. You know, and then figure out how to clean myself and figure it out. And, you know, you have to get used to everything. And, but it's just you and your mind. And a lot of people who are afraid of that experience, it's very interesting, because you get to the core of that. What are you afraid of? Well, you're afraid of your own mind. And I think we're all in some ways afraid of our mind. We're afraid of losing it. We're afraid of losing control. Well, what do you think is going to take over control if you lose it? Oh, my mind is going to take over. Well, it's you. It's all you. You're afraid of you. It's like fear of self, you know, ultimately, which is no place to live. Like, there's no way to be living with a monster in your own closet of self. I know, like, I think it's very important to look at that monster head on and say, all right, I see you. Like, I'm not going to run from you. You are me. I am you. Let's figure this out together, because you're not going to be able to escape the mind. And we do that all the time. Every little distraction, every way in which we can find something to take us out of that thing that we're feeling or experiencing or thinking, we're constantly reaching for that. But in the darkness, you have nothing to reach for. So you got to square off with that thing that you've been running from probably most of your life.
One of the things I've come to realize by speaking to so many people and I guess doing the work over the last few decades, as we call it, is everybody seems to have these certain fears that have developed. A very dear friend of mine, I know one of their deepest fears is to be alone with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And me personally, I can't fathom that, because I actually love being by myself equally as much as mm-hmm. I love being around friends and family. I don't want to say I'm neutral with all situations. Actually, I'm actually quite fearful of being in large crowds. To be honest with you, that doesn't really float my boat too much. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, there's fucking too many people here. That's something probably for me to work on. But a dear friend of mine, I said, this is something that's such an invitation for you to confront this fear of being alone. Because once you have overcome it, or maybe that's not the right terminology, but once you've learned to embrace that being alone is such a beautiful thing, equally as being with other people. But when I have spoken to her about it, the fear that I can feel the energy is like, oh, I'll do everything in my power not to be alone. I'd rather be in a dysfunctional relationship than be alone. You know, I'd rather live mm-hmm. somewhere around people than be alone. And I've encouraged them to read a book that I read maybe 30 years ago called The Wall, which is about a post-apocalyptic story of this woman and it was written, I think, nearly 80 years ago, 70 years ago after World War II, by an Austrian woman or German woman, about being alone, being the last person on the face of the planet. And yeah, what is this deep down fear of being alone, do you think? And have you ever experienced that? And did you experience it in the darkness?
Yeah, I mean, I start to, you know, it is very difficult to be alone, and also very enjoyable. you know, but fundamentally, being alone meant being dead for much of our evolutionary history. Like, humans could not survive alone. You know, I mean, there's stories of that person who's so hardy and sturdy and has everything all taken care of, usually with the help of some very powerful tools like guns and different things in a mountain where they can hunt and, you know, different ways in which they can cultivate the ground and use iron and steel. And all of these are just relatively new inventions. But back, you know, 20,000 years ago to 300,000 years ago, alone equals dead. So I think there's a very deep programming for us to be tribal creatures. And of course, we simply cannot accomplish one of our two prime directives, which is survive. And then the second being procreate. Can't do that alone. You know, that's not even possible. So there's deep, deep programming of why we don't want to be alone. But there's also a deep necessity to understand yourself. So you're not trying to fix your situation through something external, whether that's a person or whether that's something else that happens outside of you. Like, the people who have the greatest relationships are the ones that are whole within themselves. Like that Jerry Maguire line, "You complete me," is the biggest misleading load of bullshit ever said. You complete me? Well, how fucking horrible is that? How codependent does that make you on that other person? You know, even if you stay together forever, like, you're still never going to be a whole person until you find that other person. It's not going to work. It's fundamentally not going to allow you to achieve the growth that our souls come into this body to learn. So we need to learn to be alone so that we can actually learn to be in relationship, be in a sacred union where two wholes make a sum that's greater than the parts of those two whole beings. It just starts to fortify and strengthen when you meet another person in that way, and whether that's a friendship or whether that's a romantic relationship. So I see an absolute necessity to be comfortable with yourself and to know yourself. I mean, that's some of the oldest wisdom, know thyself, right? Like, that's important. And how do you know yourself until you start to take away all of the mirrors, all of the ways that you as a watcher of yourself see yourself, the stories in which you project out to watch yourself, which we always do. That's the judge. That's the what Freud called the superego, that part of us is checking out, like, you doing this right? If not, I'm not going to love you very much, and trying to figure out all of the ways we're watching ourselves. And then all of the mirrors that we put on everybody else to say, like, all right, how am I doing? How am I doing? Am I doing good? Am I worthy of love? Am I a man? Am I doing this? Let me see. Let me check my bank account. Let me check, you know, between your legs. Let me check over here what you say. Oh, did you laugh at what I said? Oh, I'm funny. Oh, that's cool. That makes me valuable. There's so many ways in which we know ourselves only through other things without actually getting to know our intrinsic inherent self. So it's essential. It's just an essential practice, but we've forgotten it because we don't have those initiations. We don't have those practices that are a part of our culture that reinforce this idea, like, hey, great, great, great. You know, community is one of the most important medicines and tools and ways in which we should live. But the only way to show up to community and be of greatest service and receive the joy and love of that community is if you're coming as a whole being yourself to the greatest extent that you can. And then from there, you can all work together on whatever it is you want to accomplish.
You mentioned the word initiation. And from my understanding, so many ancient cultures and even cultures today have these rites of passage, these initiation processes. And from all around the world, we hear of these quite frightening initiation processes that young men and women would have to go through. And I would love for you to explain what you understand about these processes or these ceremonial initiations. And some that have possibly scared you, or you've gone, whoa, that makes a lot of sense. And how do we cultivate these into our modern day 2021, 2022 lives in a meaningful way? And obviously the dark therapy is one of them. But take us through your history and your understanding of these and why they're so important for us, and some of the options that are out there for people these days.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, micro initiations that you can go through, you know, pretty simply. And it's the thing about an initiation is it's supposed to be difficult because the difficulty is what creates the growth, right? Like the living in comfort does not actually provide the pressure that creates the adaptation that's necessary for us to emerge as a different person on the other side. It has to be hard. So what are some of the things that are hard that we could do? Well, a cold plunge, it's always hard. I don't care how good you are, how many times you've done it. I mean, probably for Wim Hof himself, it's not hard. You know, he's mastered that tool to a great degree. But for the rest of us mere mortals who are not, he's like the mystic of cold plunging, right? But for the rest of us mere mortals, we look at that ice bath and we're like, damn, that looks cold. That's going to hurt a little bit. But we force ourselves to do it anyways. And we're grateful every fucking time we do it for two reasons. One, because it's going to create positive changes within our physiology, but also for the psychology of it. Yes, I know this is going to be hard. Yes, I know it's going to hurt. And yes, I have the strength to do it no matter what. I have the strength to do it even though it's hard. And so when I look at initiations, I look for things that are going to be hard, but also are going to yield a positive result. That's the benefit of cold plunging. Now, there's certain initiations that are just hard and they don't have benefit physiologically. Like, for example, there's one tribe that weaves a basket of like a wicker basket, and it looks like an oven mitt, and it's filled with bullet ants. And bullet ants are like 10 on the pain scale of like the most painful sting that you could possibly get. And it's a poison. And they put their hand in that oven mitt, and they hold it there while they're getting stung in the hand, and the whole tribe's watching, and they're going through that initiation. So the tribe knows that they're willing, that they can trust that person to not flinch in the face of pain. When the tribe needs you, that person will show up and they'll face their fear, they'll face their pain, and they'll be able to make it through, which is helpful psychologically, especially in that tribal sense when we're really that interdependent upon each other. But the actual effect of getting stung by bullet ants doesn't help anything at all. It's actually probably detrimental, right? Like your body's having to go through all of the stress and all of the healing necessary to make it through that. So I look for initiations that are going to be great for the mind, but also great for every other aspect of who you are. This is the case with a lot of the medicine journeys. You know, ayahuasca is deeply healing for the physical body in my experience. And I think research will show that in a variety of ways. Different other medicine journeys are great for healing deep-seated trauma and other things that are really ultimately beneficial. Psilocybin has been shown to have neurogenesis. Ketamine has been shown to increase BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, like the ability for us to learn and process things from a different way. So I look for things that have benefits, but are also really hard. And darkness was at the top of that list because you're getting a lot of the benefits of, you know, it's kind of a very strict diet, at least in my experience. You're at, you know, you're with yourself. You can process all of your thoughts. It's very hard and very scary. And also at the same time, you're just resting and you're in the darkness and you can stretch and try to let your nervous system recalibrate instead of being at this kind of high anxious level, which most of us are at, where the moment we wake up, we're trying to figure out what we're going to do that day and all the things we need to do. And right before we go to bed, we look with a sense of overwhelm and all of our things that we want to do the next day and the next week and the next month and all of the. And so we're in this constant, highly revved up state, but this allows you to kind of downshift, where you've got nothing in there to do. You have nothing to do. Just be. And so it met all of the criteria of what I would want from an initiation.
You mentioned the different medicines in there. And when I was watching your beautiful documentary, and I love the connection. I love the web of life because my dear friend, Ben Stewart, was the director with you, and Ben's been on this podcast, and he
absolute wizard. I'm so grateful to work with him.
He was the director for our documentary on cannabis, and I had the great pleasure of traveling through Canada and the States just prior to the pandemic with him, for me, it was forming a relationship with cannabis. Once again, in a very different way than how I used to have a relationship in my late teens right. with cannabis. I'd actually divorced myself right. from a relationship for nearly 30 years. But then I heard some of my superhero inspiring health people that taught me a lot about health and nutrition were talking about the power of cannabis. I was like, well, I'm going to have to investigate this. And and it was so interesting because after my first toad medicine journey, within 5 minutes of coming back into this reality, as Pete, this download said, you're going to start making a film about psychedelics. And it was my first psychedelic experience in 30 years. I was like, okay, how am I going to do this? And you'll find a way. And it was interesting because that led me to Ben Stewart. and I contacted Ben. I said, hey, listen, I'm a chef from Australia. I've just had a toad medicine journey. I need to make a film about this. And I believe you're the person to do it because I've just watched the Psychedelica series. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, brother, let's do it. I was like, mm-hmm. perfect. We ended up not making psychedelics, but we did the cannabis and also an ayahuasca episode. And the editor that you had, Brian Sheehan, is a gifted soul as well that can put together a story. And I know this is a long monologue from me, but when I was watching your film, I think it was around the 43, 44 minute mark, it took me back into a toad medicine experience. Just the intensity of your experience, Ben's direction and Brian's editing and obviously the music. But I was sitting there with my wife and I was like, oh, this is such a beautiful film. And then there was this scene or this moment in the film where it was just image after image after image after image. It was just and as it was going, I'm like, oh fuck, I'm going back into the medicine here. And then there was one bit, it was just boom. And I'm sitting on the couch, I'm just, oh, and I've got goosebumps now again because I can feel it. It's like, it was medicine to watch your film. And I just want to say thank you for that. And thanks to Ben and thanks
That's
to Brian.
That's beautiful, man. There's no better way that I could hope that that film comes across. I mean, this is the very unique thing about it is that you're right with me in my journey. Like I have a blacked out tape recorder during the journey. So this is not me talking about it. And then on day four, I had this deep experience where the voice of the all, the voice of the universe, the voice of God moved through me. And I understood, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, I could tell that very excitedly, but it's not the same as me being right there, recording that moment. And that moment that you're speaking of was very much like a Bufo experience, very much like a toad journey, where like I was feeling the source, the source, unicity, energy, love, God, whatever you want to call it, whatever your vocabulary permits, that place that you access. And I felt it and it moved through my voice and it was captured on the recorder. And then, you know, Ben did just an unbelievable job of stacking the right music and images to like really allow that to land in a way. So I think that's one of the beautiful aspects of this film is you're right there with me. And it would be difficult to do this if you're on ayahuasca or on another, you know, compound, because you're so altered in a way and you're so under the spell of the medicine that it's difficult to speak. Like my voice would have been all kind of jumbled and it's sometimes hard. I couldn't like live narrate a normal ayahuasca journey. It would be very difficult at the very least, you know, and disruptive for everybody else. It'd be a very weird experience. But for this, I'm there by myself. And the way that the DMT was activating, it was purely activating in my consciousness. I didn't have any physiological sensations. None of they call it in ayahuasca being seasick. You know, I wasn't like impaired in any way. So I got to be really like razor clear with what I was expressing while at the same time accessing those higher states of consciousness you can get on medicine. So it was a very unique opportunity. And I'm just glad that, you know, a couple times I made a few prayers being like, man, I hope this tape recorder actually is recording something. As if not, because I had no idea to tell. I couldn't see it. I just had to memorize how to turn it off and on. And then at one point I panicked and thought, wait, what if I confused it? What if off was on and on was off? And I've been fucking this up the whole time, you know? So, yeah, it was, it's a really powerful, it's a journey. And that's really what I want, is I want people to be able to go on this journey with me and have their own journey along with me. And Ben helped make that possible.
I want to go back into the initiation process, because generally whenever I do these podcasts, it's so fascinating for me because, as you can tell, I never prepare anything, and I've mentioned this before in podcasts, but my preparation is taking awareness of what has caught my attention generally over the past week. That's generally how I weave the interview, is what has made itself known for me over the last day, the last week, whatever it is. And it's fascinating because when I'm with a guest and we're having this dialogue and you're speaking, I'm like, oh, that there's a reason why that entered my awareness this week. And now you've spoken about it. Let's just talk about initiation. And it was funny because I was looking for the shirt this morning and I found this. I was like, this is the shirt I need to wear. And have you interviewed J.P. Sears before, or do you know him?
I have, yeah. Yeah. We're good friends.
Beautiful, beautiful human being. And my wife, Nick, showed me one of his posts this week. And it was him standing with Donald Trump. And I think it was JP's wife. Mm-hmm. And he did a post basically saying, and basically, I need to apologize to myself and to others because I had judged this man in a very negative way from everything that was fed to me from friends and media. But I'm here to say that, you know, I support Donald Trump. And when I was reading, I was like, "Look, that it nearly feels like an initiation process for JP, like to be able sure. to fucking sure. stand there on Instagram of all places and go,
yeah,
yeah. I know, and I could feel the energy. I know people aren't going to like what I've just shared or what I'm sharing here, but I need to do this for myself. And one of the things that I've seen over the last year and a half is talking about some of the people that have really inspired me over the years that I thought would be able to see through this narrative that is playing out. They've done a complete 180 from where I thought my superheroes would be. It's like the superhero that I've perceived on certain individuals in the health space have taken off their superhero costume and gone back to being Clark Kent, you know, meek and mild and sort of hiding away from the opportunity to stand up and go through the next rites of initiation, so to speak, and deeply question what is going on. And this is a difficult one for me because I'm projecting my own stuff here and projecting what I think others would do. But I found it quite challenging going, fuck, they took that and they're promoting that? Mm-hmm. Fuck. Like it still triggers me. It's like,
yeah.
How?
Yeah. And it's not only that direction though, because I've also seen some people who I thought were like, oh, they've really got it dialed. Like I would trust this person's ability to assess the situation, and they've gone full blown the other way. And, you know, I went to an election party that was with a bunch, like really a lot of the spiritual community here in Austin. And it was like a kind of a pro-Trump election party, which I wasn't particularly aware of and didn't particularly expect because it was an election party. And I have a very nuanced opinion of Trump, where I see his blustering flaws that are obvious, you know, like the guy, you know, and I just released a clip today where it was me and Charles Eisenstein saying, we don't know the man and we don't, you know, it's so difficult to judge. He's a giant projection screen, but you know, there are some things that we can see, some tweets that came from his thumbs and some words that came from his mouth. And it's pretty clear that he's not the Messiah. Like he's just not the Messiah. You know, he doesn't have the plan to save the country and fucking figure everything out. And he's got it all dialed and wired. And he's got a plan, you know, and his plan might be better than somebody else's plan, but like, don't get crazy. He's not like, this is not Professor Xavier with fucking Cerebro and he's got all this shit sorted out. And this is our, like, this is the best we can do. Like, come on. But there were people like that who were saying things like, you know, he is the best person we could possibly have and the only person who could blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, whoa, like, y'all chill out. You know, like I'm with it. I'm down. I think if I have to pick the lesser of, you know, the lesser of two evils here, like I'm with you. Yeah, I'm fucking with you. But chill, like everybody chill, you know, like relax. So I just want to say that and just that I see that side of what you're saying. And then I've also seen the other side where I've seen some people get caught in their own Messiah complex of projecting onto him all of these other things that I don't perceive to be true. Now, maybe he is fucking Professor X and Cerebro all combined. I don't see it, but you know, that's fine. But it's interesting how this has been a global initiation that has revealed, as initiations do, where there are cracks and those cracks become exposed. You apply pressure to a fractured bone. Like that's how you can tell if you have a fracture in your bone, right? You may not know, is my bone fractured? I don't know. If I move it around like this, it feels fine. All right, we'll take some pressure. Let me squeeze your arm, squeeze that radius and ulna and put a little pressure. And then as the bone is supposed to flex, that point where it's supposed to flex is gonna send shooting pain right at that spot where you're fractured. And you'll know, right? And that's what's really happened is like, the world has contracted and there's pressure everywhere. And so it's a big revelation of where people are. Are they prone to fear? Are they prone to manipulation? Are they prone to virtue signaling and pretending that they're better than somebody else? Are they prone to, you know, looking for a savior or a messiah? What are people prone to? And then, you know, really the real diamonds have emerged, the ones that have like, yeah, I've dealt with my shit and I still got more shit, but this amount of pressure is not going to reveal anything that I haven't seen because I've put myself under enough pressure that I've already pre-revealed all of these fucking traps and cracks that might have been there. You know, so this global thing, like I'm ready for it. And that's like a big part of my messages. And I say that in the film. You can either wait for the darkness to come upon you and hope that you're in a good position, or you go out and find the darkness and make sure that whatever darkness comes, you're fucking ready. And, you know, I think what we've seen here is that a lot of people have walked the, you know, talked the talk, but when it came time to walk the walk, when a little bit of pressure was applied, you know, we're seeing where their weaknesses are. And that's no judgment. It's just a matter of they haven't gone through the initiations and the preparation to become self-aware of their own, you know, the stuff that they may be vulnerable to. And that's, I think, what we've seen globally.
You mentioned Charles Eisenstein, and firstly, I want to thank you for summing that up. That was absolutely beautiful. And we have, over the last year and a half, I've seen so many people that have really championed for health, and a beautiful man like Charles, who we've interviewed a few times on this platform, and we're very grateful for his perspectives on everything, because I see him as a very grounded human being that is not usually swayed too much. You know, he has this mind where he can, it's like a beautiful mind, he can look at so many different ways and relate to all the different ways of that people perceive things. And even for somebody like Charles, and I think he'd be okay with me saying this, but I believe it was his son that ended up taking a vaccine, and he shared that with us. And it was like, whoa, you know, and it's happened over and over and over and over again, where people that have nearly spent their whole life trying to, or I shouldn't say trying, but looking at things from so many different perspectives, and they're still being challenged in so many different ways, like whether it be their family member taking a vaccine, even though the family member probably knows it may not be the best thing for them, but they do it anyway.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
And there seems to be so much pressure in this realm to comply. And I don't want to judge anybody for their actions, because I'm not them. So they have to choose what's right for them. But for so many people listening to this and watching this, and I know that our audience is going through some pretty heavy times with family members that have taken something, a medical intervention, that they may probably be in a state of fear. You know, my son, my daughter, my mom, my father, my grandparents, my friends, my best friends have taken something, and all of my being knows that a pharmaceutical company, from all the research that we've done, doesn't normally have people's best interests at heart completely. You know, that's my perception, even though there are some great life-saving drugs that pharmaceutical companies make.
Sure.
So how do people, what advice would you give to people that are listening to this or watching this, and even myself, where friends and family have gone along and taken something that you believe may not be in their best interest, that may shorten their life, that may bring up injuries that we just don't know? Like, how do we stay out of that fear, like, fuck, you took it? Yeah, sorry, I'm a little bit scrambling here, because
it makes sense.
It's a big one. It's probably the hugest one.
Sure, I get it. And if we've done any research at all into the placebo effect and the nocebo effect, we recognize how powerful the mind is in creating a positive result or actually exacerbating a negative result. Right? Like, there was an individual. Usually his name is on the tip of my tongue, but I can't recall it right now. But anyways, he went to the doctor, and the doctor told him, oh man, you have stage 4 esophageal cancer. You're going to die, and you don't have very much time to live. I think his name might've been Thomas Lund or something like that. Very famous case. And so the doctor tells him he's going to die. So he goes and he says goodbye to his family, and he dies within like a week of that diagnosis. And then they do an autopsy, and they're like, oh no, he didn't have cancer at all. Like, what did we do? You know? And so the nocebo was actually strong enough that he died. He willed himself to death with just the information that the belief that he was going to die. And you hear about this in tribal cultures, where there'll be a shaman or a witch doctor who will give someone the evil eye, and then within days they'll get sick and perish. Well, what is that? It's their mind. They believe that that's going to happen, so it happens. And then on the converse side, the placebo effect, which is accounted for in every clinical trial. And Joe Dispenza, you go to any Joe Dispenza, you know, week-long retreat, you'll have hundreds of people who tell their stories of healing from stage 4 cancer, this and this debilitating condition, this, all by their own mind putting themselves in a state in which they already believe that they're healed, and then creating that reality. I think we've been fed a narrative where we really don't give enough credit for how powerful we are and what an incredible tool our mind is to shape our reality. And that's Joe Dispenza's book, You Are the Placebo. Like, how do you use this mechanism to the best effect possible and avoid the negative side of this, the dark side of the placebo, the nocebo effect? So my advice to everybody is, yes, there are, you know, biological implications of this vaccine, you know, that are real. However, your mind is going to either accelerate or decelerate whatever, you know, issue might be arising from that. So if you do have a friend or family member who's going to do this, I think it's important to share your case, but avoid trying to isolate them and avoid your judgment and try to really see through their eyes. Like, it's only like the very first level to be right. But the next level that we should aspire to is not only to be right, quote in quotes, but to be able to be the bridge to really see through another person's perspective and hold like a deep compassion and reverence for their perspective. And I think that's what ultimately is going to create the most inroads and allow you to have access to, you know, be in dialogue and have that conversation. Because if you come adversarial and confrontational, you'll probably just push yourself away. It's the same if someone's in a shitty relationship. And if you like walk up to them and be like, that guy's an asshole, you should dump him immediately. I don't know what the fuck you're doing. You're out of your mind. Like, just dump them already. You know, that's not really the best way to be there for them, would be to like, just talk to them and help them understand and highlight some things that they can see for themselves and allow them to make the decision, which ultimately they're going to make anyways. But I think too often people have isolated themselves from family because they're not willing to be the bridge in between and set down their right beliefs for a little while to just go down the road with that other person and really give you some access to hopefully, you know, make them aware of the decisions they're making. And then if they do make that decision, you know, this is the thing that I've had to say to many, many people in my fit for service community, et cetera. If they do go ahead and make the decision, like, know that you're going in and you're going to handle this vaccine with absolute, like, impeccability in the way that your body is going to respond to it. And you are going to emerge from this without any of the negative effects and only benefiting in the best way possible that you can from this. This is not poison, that this is something that you can handle and that you're going to utilize, your immune system's going to utilize it to the best effect possible. And it's all going to be, you know, perfect. And you have to really get yourself to that position, because I think the most dangerous spot to be in is to reluctantly get the shot and then be afraid of it the whole time. Because then the moment you start to feel something negative, your mind is going to start going like, oh my God, is my heart okay? Like, am I going to topple over and die? And that's going to start to really, you know, exaggerate the negative effects that you're experiencing from the jab. So I think it's like about really understanding someone's perspective. And then when they're a yes, and you know that you're not changing their mind, just really hype them up about how good their body, how strong their body is, how capable their immune system is to directing this in the perfect way possible, and get them like, be like their, give them like a pep talk about how awesome they are and how they're going to handle this so beautifully, so that you can help mitigate some of those effects that the mind can, you know, play into this situation.
I've had that thought that, you know, if they were to come around and forcefully hold the last remaining people down in this country, because most people have, I think we're up to 90% or 95%, and it's whittling down, you know, so it'll be easy to pick people off, you know, if they
yeah,
have
sure.
to. I was like, okay, Mr. Evans, how will you deal with this? How will you deal with this? Mm-hmm. And the thought has come up. It's not so much the fear. It's like, okay, well, if that was to happen, what state do I have to bring my body and mind and spirit into to be able to process this? You know, mm-hmm. my choice, I'll leave it for now. But if it was to get to that stage, which it may very well get to, you know, I don't wish it to happen, you know, forced medical intervention. But there is a possibility. And if there's a possibility, sure. it may come true. Like, okay, so
mm-hmm.
yeah. Am I ready for that if it manifests?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I probably got some more work to do on that, like we all do.
Yeah, I mean, this is some deep Jedi shit right here. Like, imagine if it was actually poison, right? Like, there's stories of people, like, take the story of Rasputin. You know, he was poisoned with enough, I believe it was arsenic, that could have killed like several elephants. And he just fucking shrugged it off. He was like, yeah. And then they shot him, and then they stabbed him, and then they wrapped him in chains and threw him in an icy river. And he still shed the chains and clawed his way to the riverbank, right? Why? Because Rasputin had a particularly different body than us? No. He's just mind. His mind was so strong. I mean, Wim Hof had frostbite on all of his toes, and he just sat there breathing and meditating about all of the blood and capillaries going back into his toes and his toes coming back from frostbite. Well, that doesn't happen, but he made it happen. You know, like, we have that, this Jedi power that even if it is pure poison, you know, even if it is just pure poison, we can still transmute that with our own mind. Like, we have that power. Like, I really believe in the power of the human being to alter reality, especially as it affects our own body. You know, I mean, we may not be Neo, you know, we can't stop a bullet with our mind or anything like that. There is Newtonian causality. You know, we are in that dimension, but we can do a lot with our own energetic field. I was even talking to a guy named Matthias DiStefano, who's this mystic cosmic encyclopedia of remembered lives and information. And someone asked him, you know, well, I'm worried about, like, what if they're injecting nanotechnology into our bodies to control us, right? Someone who'd gone down that rabbit hole. And Matthias was like, well, if you actually cultivate your own toroidal field, you can short circuit any of that, you know, electronics that are actually happening in your body anyway. So it doesn't matter. Like, ultimately, if we cultivate our spiritual potential, we can circumvent so much more than we think we can, you know, and whether that's 5G or whether that's nanobots or whether that's whatever, like, we still have the power to do far more than we think we're capable of. And perhaps this pressure is going to reveal those adaptations, right? Like, it's part of the classic X-Men story. Like, how do they understand that they're mutants and that they have these superpowers? Well, they go through some really hard shit. And through the really hard shit that they go through, something emerges and something extraordinary reveals itself. And maybe this is this collective awakening for us to recognize that we are not simply Homo sapiens anymore. We're Homo magicus. We're a magical fucking being. We're Jedis in training. And, you know, maybe it takes the rise of the two towers, or, you know, a dark force of control to help bring about the reawakening of our Jedi skills. Who knows? You know, so these are all different ways that I look at things with a slightly different perspective. And it really allows me to be at greater peace. Like, okay, you know, like, what brought the dwarves and the humans and the elves and the wizards all together? Well, it was the rise of Mordor. It was the rise of the two towers. Like, they were all just bickering amongst themselves. Some were fucking off in the Shire. Some were over there in the mountains. Some were over there in the woods. Some were over there building castles and, you know, warring with each other, riding around on horses. And then all of a sudden they're like, shit, you know, like, we gotta resist the darkness together. So they came together and created something greater than any of them had ever experienced before, the Fellowship of the Ring. And this is kind of what's happening now to a certain degree. And I'm not trying to say that what we're dealing with is a pure evil to the extent of Mordor, but it certainly seems a little evil in certain places. And not all the responses are pure good, but there is these deep, deep kind of mythopoetic underpinnings to this story that we can look at. And perhaps with hindsight, looking back, being like, damn, that was a really hard time and a lot of people suffered, but it was what we needed to bring us to our next level of evolution.
I recently watched the trilogy again, the extended version, just over the last month.
Mm-hmm.
Tolkien's books were very powerful for me in my early years, and I think I've watched Lord of the Rings, I think, 10 times over.
it's so good.
I was saying to Nick the other night, we were sitting on the couch, I said, he just had such a way of showing the different archetypes of and just so relevant for now as well, with the environment, with the with the ants, with the trees, and the power of the power of nature. And I think that's one of the key messages in Tolkien's work, is that that relationship with nature, that we, because you watch the film or you read the book, and pretty much every time that they got into trouble, it was nature that helped them, you know, in the least likely of places. And yeah, so powerful. What was going back into the dark room? What were your fractures? What did you realize that needed mending or needed needed more healing in that experience, that perhaps you thought you'd already you'd already healed that, and you're like, fuck, I still got that.
Oh man, there was a lot of those.
I thought I banished that dragon, that demon, out of me.
There was a lot of those. Yeah. You know, it was, there's one part in the documentary that doesn't have context, but I'm just talking to the tape recorder and I'm saying, why does the mind keep going back to these things? And it just keeps going back. And what I was particularly referring to was my partner, Whitney. This was before I'd met Vailana. I mean, I'd met Vailana, but before Vailana and I had gotten together. And so I was still, you know, kind of seeing Whitney. We weren't technically together, but we were still, you know, relating and intimate with each other when I was in the darkness. And I still was having difficulty with one boyfriend that she had like 3 years prior. And I was like, I got in there to the darkness and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. This again? How many times do I have to deal with this? Can go already, finish this, like be done. But I had to finally work into the final solution for this. And, you know, that's a storyline that we didn't feel like we needed to tell in the documentary, but that was what prompted that thought of like the mind just looping back to this same thing, because I hadn't actually excavated all the way to the root cause and the real perspective that could shift everything. So, you know, that's just one example of many of the things that I tackled. But it, the overarching thing was that I was afraid to let myself fully be loved because I was afraid of that love going away. And that means being loved by the world. That means being loved by my partners, even being loved by my mom. You know, I was afraid that if I would let that love in and that love went away, it would hurt too bad. So I was limiting, I was putting a ceiling on the amount of love that I experienced, just in the, you know, off chance that that love might go away. And that's no way to live. That's not the way to live with courage. You know, so that was a deep, deep lesson that came from this.
Well, you are loved, brother. Yeah, you're deeply loved.
Thank you, brother. So are you.
The last part of the journey into the darkness, we were conducting a breathwork ceremony on the weekend for some of our guests at the retreat. And the one thing I said was, you know, this is different from a psychedelic journey, where if you have a psychedelic journey, when you drink the medicine or whatever it may be, you're sort of locked and loaded. You can't escape generally or ever. But I said with breathwork, you know, if at any point in time you need to stop wherever you are, you can simply come back to normal breath. You're in control. You know, that's one of the beautiful things about breath work, is it can be very profound, but also can, you're still driving. You're still in the front seat driving.
Yeah, totally.
Most of the time. And with the dark room, as you said, after 3 days for you that you were in there, it was on for the next 3 days with the DMT activation. Could you turn it off? Could you stop if you wanted to, or is
I could have, I mean, the only way to stop is to really permanently stop it, which is to go into the light. So that was the only, there was only one way out, you know, and the one way out was to end it. So that's also difficult too, because in an ayahuasca journey, there's no way out. You got no way out. You're in there. And no matter what, it's not your choice. Like, so you might as well stay in the maloca and you might as well deal with your shit and, you know, puke and fucking cry and do what you breathe and do what you got to do to make it through, because you got no other choice. But I had to grapple with the fact that, yeah, I could walk right out of that room. I knew the way out. The doors weren't locked. I could walk my way out, go sit outside, and the journey is over. And so I had to grapple with that voice in my head many, many times. It was like, you got what you came here for, bud. All good. You know, wrap it up. Time to go. You know, 2 days in the darkness. That's great. It's more than most. You know, go for it. Spend some time in the trees. You know, you can meditate and it'll be great. And I had to like wrestle with that voice. Be like, no, nope, nope. And one time I actually was so convinced that I was done. This was at the end of day four, that I actually, there's a little buzzer that I could hit that would call the retreat director to come talk to me. And I hit it and she comes talk to me. I said, I think I'm done. I think I got what I came here for. I think I'm ready to leave now. And she says, okay, well, maybe just stay in one more day and see. And I'm like, nope, I'm pretty sure I'm good. I'm done. You know, I've done this a long time. I'm good. She's like, yeah, well, just, you know, stay in one more day and then see. And if you want to go out tomorrow, you can. And sure enough, you know, I stay in one more day. And then some of the deepest revelations started to come to me. And I'm so grateful that I did. But it was, that part was hard. That part was hard. It was hard to wrestle with that aspect. I just wanted to be like, I'm out of here. I'll do something else.
What's next for Aubrey? What initiation processes? How do you work out what's next for you? I mean, for me, it's my intuition. And it's like, mm-hmm. Okay, that's calling me now. How does it work for you? Because some people are just explorers where they've got their list and they're like,
yeah.
And I'm keen to know how it works for you. And do you have have you got this worked out? As in, what steps next?
I do. I mean, so much of what I've realized is that the best drug I've ever taken is service. Service is the best drug I've ever taken. Like when you take it pure and you're not thinking about you and you're just thinking about being of service, like that is the best drug. And I was apprenticed in a particular style of body work from my brother Porangi, and it's something that felt like it was, while I was learning, it was also me remembering something that I've always known. And I learned how to stack that with a particular combination of ketamine, cannabis, darkness, and breath work, and the right music. And so I've been able to offer that to people. So the combination of body work, darkness, breath work, ketamine, cannabis, and music. So, and I've offered that in a very, and it's been an unbelievably powerful experience for people. And that was like step one of me recognizing, and it's an amazing experience for me because I get in full trance. I'm like in an absolute total trance. So it's like the deepest flow state I can ever achieve. And then, you know, really the invitation for me was like, all right, what's the next step? Like, how do you expand this into like a full day of service to somebody, where that's akin to, you know, let's say the old mystery schools, like what that was like. And to me, that's the thing. It doesn't scale, you know, and I have a lot of things at scale. I have ideas. I have this idea for an institution called United Polarity, which is built upon shared reverence and the appreciation of ideas on both sides of controversial issues. I have ideas for films and books and things at scale. But really also I'm very keen on trying to figure out what are the tools to hack into the operating system and really create, you know, absolutely life-altering, transformative experiences for, you know, those in my inner circle, my friends and my family and people who I can really be of service to. So that seems to be the most exciting for me. So there's a little bit of exploration as I'm exploring different methodologies and modalities and different plant extracts and, you know, researching kana a lot and different, you know, kind of admixture herbs. I'm trying to do this in a way that everything that's offered is legal. Just because I don't want to deal with, even though I'm only offering it privately to people, like I'd like to do this in a fully legal way where they have a, you know, a prescription for ketamine. We're in a cannabis legal, you know, state and, you know, everything else that we do is fully legal. So I can talk about it and talk about it honestly. I mean, I won't talk about people's experience, but just talk about how this actually rolls. So that's the limitations that I'm putting on myself. And I'm really curious to see what that reveals, because I've explored so much myself. It's now about like, all right, how do I share this in a meaningful way and then open source what I've learned so that people can bring themselves through a transformational experience that is, you know, incredibly powerful.
And what do you, Aubrey Marcus, get from that? I mean, you said it's the most powerful drug, being of service, but and being in that flow state. How do you feel in that role?
It just answers the question of what am I doing? Why am I here? And am I doing enough? Which is like constant. These questions are constantly like dripping into my consciousness. What are you doing? Why are you here? And are you doing enough? But when I'm in pure service, I know that there's nothing better, more, or different that I could be doing. You know, it feels like, all right, like I'm doing the most important work that I could possibly do right now. And there's just such a great joy in that. And that's to me why it's the best drug I've ever taken.
Last question, if you don't mind. When I had Luke's story on a year ago or so, like yourself, you have interviewed countless people, leaders in their field. Mm-hmm. From all around the world in all different modalities. Is it becoming simpler for you or more complicated with the more information that you have gained?
Both. I mean, there's more tools at my disposal, but there's more opportunities to go deeper, right? So, and now also with the additional resources from the sale of Onnit, it's like, here you go, bro. You can do anything you fucking want. What do you want to do? And I'm like, fuck, I have no constraints. And then the universe is like, nope, no constraints. Have at it. And I'm like, what do I do? I don't know. So it's a beautiful place to be in. It's a place of boundless opportunity and possibility. But that CEO function of, okay, you can't do it all. You have to choose this or choose that. That's becoming more challenging because there's so many things that I love and so many ways in which I can be of service to the world. Which ones do I choose and what do I prioritize? And can I do it without being stressed out and second guessing myself? So, you know, that's the spot that I'm in right now.
Which is another initiation ongoing.
Another initiation. Here we go.
Oh, brother.
Here we go.
I know you, I don't even want to say you're a busy man because that's me projecting, but I just want to thank you once again for sharing your beautiful perspectives on life and love and what it means to be human. Or what was that word? The Homo Magic.
Homo Magicus. Homo Magicus.
And you know what's fascinating about that? Yeah. Yesterday, and because you spoke about the Jedi, it was yesterday I shared a Narco song called On the Verge, which has beautiful lyrics. And I know he's a dear friend of yours, as he is to us. The day before I shared Jamiroquai's song on my Telegram page. And one of my favorite songs that he ever produced was called Use the Force. And if you've never listened to it or you don't, check it out, read the lyrics or sing the lyrics, because it's a very powerful, powerful mantra and the music is just so uplifting. So you are using the force, my friend, And I love you. And thank you once again.
I love you too, brother. Yeah, absolutely. And for those interested in the documentary, just you can find it at aubreymarcus.com, and that's where it's streaming.
See you, legend. Bye-bye.
All right. Adios, brother.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.